It's Monday, August 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, tensions remain high on the Korean Peninsula amid talks between the North and South. We hear from a U.S. ambassador on the Islamic State dilemma.
There are many causes of violence, and part of the problem is that we see violence as an overarching problem when in fact it's a thousand different problems.
An author shares the root causes of violence in society, and the world greets two new Washington residents, all coming up on today's program. North and South Korean officials resumed marathon talks Sunday afternoon and continued deep into the night in an urgent bid to avert potential conflict on the peninsula. Initial talks that began Saturday were adjourned 10 hours later in the early hours of Sunday, and officials have not publicly commented on the discussions. There is also no word on whether the negotiations are making any progress or how long they will continue. However, as the talks started up again Sunday, South Korea reported unusual troop and submarine movement in the north. Pyongyang has moved 70% of its submarines away from their bases, and the vessels are now undetectable, according to South Korea's defense ministry. A ministry spokesman characterized the movement as unprecedented. The North has also doubled its frontline artillery strength at the border with the South, according to South Korea. To discuss the latest during the very early morning hours in Seoul is Steve Miller of Asia News Weekly. Steve, I understand there was also a brief pause in the U.S.-South Korea military exercises.
Yeah, so the annual games were underway, and they briefly paused them. And I think that was just a measure of a sign of how Seoul was reacting to the tensions from North Korea. The games were actually paused really briefly and then set to go back in motion. So I don't think it was necessarily a good indicator that the United States was truly worried, but really wanted to pause and really coordinate all efforts with Seoul just to make sure there weren't any hiccups should something go down that would be a rather negative aspect.
We've been hearing a lot of rhetoric from North Korea, at least through the international media. What have you been hearing in Seoul?
Well, we hear the same bellicose rhetoric being reported through major news organizations, including Yonhap here in South Korea. But to the average person on the street, the average person in Seoul, it's still business as usual. We see this as part of the typical cycle of escalation of tensions by North Korea, then the eventual dance that decreases them, and we get into a lull. What I think people are a little more concerned about this time is that we are seeing some troop movements near the border, the deployment of 50 out of their 70 submarines recently, and the recall of all the F-16s from Alaska. I think that's a little bit different than we saw, say, in 2013, last time we had this amount of tension on the peninsula. But for the average person, it's still the same thing we see, so there isn't a lot of concern out on the streets.
You mentioned the movement of submarines, and this is something a little bit unusual, I guess, that we really haven't encountered before.
Right, and that was one of the things that a lot of analysts picked up on, and this kind of deployment of submarines is largely unprecedented, and known why North Korea opted to do that. Some feel that perhaps the talks in Panmunjom are just a diversionary tactic, and some of the submarines may carry out operations. It's really unclear. As you know, over in the northern limit line area, over in the western border of the Koreas, it's not exactly the most secure area, and there have been skirmishes in the past, so there is a potential for something to happen there.
There were some intense talks going on between the North and the South. Is that a usual occurrence when things tend to flare up like this?
Well, it's typically what we want to see. We always want to see that dialogue going on. The talks began Sunday evening, lasted way into the early mornings on Sunday, and then they resumed Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening. And as we're having this conversation, they're still reporting that the talks are still going on at this moment with no details being released. So hopefully this is the phase that we typically see where both sides can come together, can come and reach an agreement that will ultimately de-escalate the tension.
All throughout this, there's a common theme of reunification, at least getting some of the families together that have been separated. How's that going?
Well, that's always what we want to see. This time of year, Chuseok, the Korean Thanksgiving, will occur towards the end of September of 2015. And it's always nice to try and get families together that were separated by the 1950-1953 Korean War. And sometimes in the past, North Korea has used that as a bargaining chip to try and get either sanctions alleviated or some other kind of aid from South Korea or the West. So they could possibly even use that as some kind of bargaining chip to get those propaganda speakers turned off, promise to hold family reunions this year. And it could be a pathway to finally de-escalate the situation.
Well, it's always nice to speak with you. From Seoul, Steve Miller. He's a radio, television, and internet travel news expert. And you can hear him podcasting at Asia News Weekly. Right, Steve?
That's right. Thank you, Jim.
Well, to check out what's trending on social media about the latest developments on the Korean Peninsula, no one better to turn to than our own G. Abby Lee. G's in our studio. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
The tensions are rising. How is the Twitter world responding to that?
Well, Steve was absolutely right when he said in the Q&A that for an average person, it's business as usual in South Korea, and that's definitely reflected on Twitter. Now, to give you a feel for it, hashtag Korea was used less than hashtag K-pop, which means Korean pop music. So both hashtags were used in about 4,000 tweets respectively during the last 24 hours. And if you think about it, Jim, hashtag Korea encompasses everything from inter-Korean relations to food and soap drama, also known as K-drama. I must say a lot of tweets that used hashtag Korea weren't talking about the security issues.
Well, what about some of the Twitter handles that we can follow to keep up on the news?
Well, Steve Miller for Asia News Weekly podcast, the one we just heard from, is on Twitter at Steve Miller ANW. And our own Steve Herman at W7VOA is also a prolific Twitter user. He's VOA's Southeast Asia Bureau Chief, but he worked from Seoul, South Korea for a few years. And last but not least, the first AP Bureau Chief in Pyongyang, Jean Lee, is also on Twitter at NewsJean. She's also on Instagram with the same handle and posts very insightful and rare photos from both Koreas. As for Washington officials, neither Secretary of State John Kerry nor President Barack Obama has tweeted about either Korea Sunday. Jim, as tensions rise along the demilitarized zone, a VOA article published 3 days ago is getting a lot of traffic on the website. Do you have an idea as to what it is?
No. Which one is it?
It's a piece written by the Korean Service titled Experts Predict North Korea Will Escalate Provocations, and that's exactly what's happening right now. So in some ways, the skirmishes were more or less expected. In that article, experts said tensions will continue to rise until the Washington Seoul Summit slated for mid-October. Jim?
Well, always great analysis from G. Abby Lee. Thank you so much for joining us. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. The Islamic State group's claim to be an Islamic caliphate has raised concerns that its ambitions to capture and administer territory have no geographic limits. International Edition correspondent Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, a former coordinator of the State Department's Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications, about the rise of the Islamic State group and tells colleague Susan Yaki about its plan to counter IS propaganda.
He mentioned several causes, starting with the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the U.S. inaction toward the Syrian crisis, the economic grievances in the Middle East, and political exclusion, among other factors.
After the Arab Spring, you had weakened states, you had anarchy develop in Syria, and you had a dysfunctional, incompetent government in Iraq. So there was a vacuum, there was an ungoverned space that the Islamic State sought to fill. And so you basically, the implosion that happened in Syria and the implosion that happened, the vacuum that was created in Iraq by the terrible mistakes of the Maliki government, gave a tremendous opportunity for these extremists to put their ideas, their Takfiri, Salafi, Jihadi ideas into effect.
According to Ambassador Fernandez, that is the same approach Al-Qaeda adopted in other places like northern Mali, Somalia, parts of Yemen, and in northern Nigeria.
But President Obama said the international community needs to address grievances that terrorists exploit, including economic and political issues.
Well, Ambassador Fernandez acknowledged that dealing with the rise of the Islamic State should be a multi-pronged approach, not only in the battlefield. He said it should include better governance, dealing with the socio-economic grievances, deconstructing the hateful ideology of ISIS, opening the political space, and avoiding painting all Islamists with one broad brush as violent extremists.
It won't drive everyone into the ranks of the Islamic State, but it will encourage people to go there. Because if you're accused of being something that you're not, you might as well do it, right? No, this is the problem, the question of political Islam, of the role of Islam expressed in a political world. We have to find a way to do that.
Ambassador Fernandez argued that you can physically crush a group of fighters belonging to ISIS, but if the reasons behind their ideology and if the appeal to join the Islamic State continued, then you did not solve any problem.
International Edition correspondent Mohammed El-Shenawy, he was speaking with Susan Yaki. Violence among young people seems to be getting worse in the United States and elsewhere, but what can be done about it? Author Jan Arno considers youth violence in her latest book, In the Line of Fire, Raising Kids in a Violent World. And she spoke with VOA's Susan Yaki.
There are many causes of violence. And part of the problem is that we see violence as an overarching problem when in fact it's a thousand different problems. It's as if a doctor would say to you, oh, you have an illness, and then walk away. And of course, if you don't know what he's talking about, what kind of illness, you wouldn't know what to do about it. But if someone said, oh, you have a ductal type 2 tumor, and it's in this place, and it's this big, and, you know, you would know that possibly that was breast cancer, and you would know what to do about it.
Can you give us some as an example?
Yes. The earliest kind of violence, I believe, and it's sometimes difficult to understand from adult perspectives, is when we read children and allow children to read early childhood literature that is racist and sexist. I note in my book many different kinds of literature, many different titles, that when read to a child from the arms of a caregiver, the child takes that as the gospel truth. We go on from there into video games and allowing children free range of video games. The more violent, the better, because that's what holds their attention. And that moves right along into school, where we get bullying on the playground and in the classroom, and into further into community violence, neighborhood violence, domestic violence. So we have a small biological factor of violence. Kids are not born to hate and to be violent. They learn it. But then there are some children who are more prone to it than others. We have the family situation where if a child sees the parents screaming at each other or father bullying the mother, then that's what the child learns to do. That's what the child feels is normal. We see all kinds of things on television these days, not just the fiction, the programs that we see, but also in the news. We have small children watching the news, wondering if their school is going to be bombed or if their neighborhood is going to have a school shooter around. And it goes on from there all the way through to hate crime in the community.
Author Jan Arno and her new book, In the Line of Fire, Raising Kids in a Violent World. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
That's the sound of one of two newborn giant panda cubs being examined at the National Zoo here in Washington. No, it's not a squeezy toy. Zoo officials say they have apparently a healthy pair of twins born late Saturday to panda mom Mei Xiang. In more than three decades of trying to breed pandas at the National Zoo, though, there has been plenty of heartbreak. More cubs born here in Washington have died rather than survived. And pandas don't usually nurse their twins on their own. They care for one and allow the other to die. But in the past decade, Chinese breeders have come up with a new system of delicately swapping the cubs every several hours. One is with a mother, and the other is kept in an incubator, and then they swap them. Panda keepers at the Smithsonian's National Zoo performed a successful first swap early Sunday, and that technique also helped twin pandas born 2 years ago at Zoo Atlanta to survive. We wish them well. Well, one of the biggest jazz artists among Asian audiences continues his reign atop the music charts as we hear more from International Edition colleague Steve Norman.
Do you recognize that sound? That's right, it's jazz saxophonist Kenny G, who by most standards is the biggest-selling instrumental musician and one of the best-selling artists of all time. Girl from Ipanema is off his recently released album, Brazilian Nights. The 58-year-old sold more than 75 million records since 1973. When still in high school, he started his career in music, playing sax in Barry White's Love Unlimited Orchestra. Kenny G's first solo album came out in 1982 with a rapid succession of dozens of records over the years and numerous singles, including Songbird. When released in 1987, it became the first instrumental to reach the top 40 of the Billboard Hot 100. We'll be right back. Kenny G was an instant success. His tours worldwide were sold out, and he became one of the highest paid performers of all time. Silhouette followed Songbird as Kenny G's next hit single, reaching number one on the contemporary jazz chart.
Been listening to International Edition. A lot of people, of course, like Kenny G. We hope you like us on Facebook. Visit us at VOA Asia. We're also on Twitter at VOA_IE, and you can email us voaasia@voanews.com. Of course, our website is always there, 24/7, voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is gravely concerned about the plight of the Rohingya population in Southeast Asia. The Rohingya are a Muslim minority population of around 1.2 million people living in Burma's Rakhine State, where they are subject to religious-based discrimination and violence and exploitative conditions, including forced labor by the Burma Army, undue restrictions on freedom of movement, and impeded access to medical care and food. They are restricted in marriage and building or maintaining religious buildings. Despite living in Burma for generations, they are made stateless by policies set by previous military regimes. Tens of thousands live in camps for internally displaced persons with little access to livelihoods, markets, food, or places of worship. They have become increasingly vulnerable to human traffickers who entice them with promises of a better life abroad. Up to an estimated 500,000 undocumented Rohingya refugees live in neighboring Cox's Bazar district in Bangladesh, and around 32,000 registered Rohingya live in the district's Kutupalong and Nayapata refugee camps, having fled military campaigns and sustained persecution in Rakhine State. The United States has consistently called on the Burmese government to improve the humanitarian situation in Rakhine State by allowing unrestricted humanitarian access to all communities in need and facilitating the voluntary return of all internally displaced Rohingya to their places of origin. President Obama voiced his concerns earlier this summer.
I think if I were Rohingya, I would want to stay where I was born. I'd want to stay in the land where my parents had lived, but I'd want to make sure that my government was protecting me and that people were treating me fairly. That's what I'd want. And that's why it's so important, I think, as part of the democratic transition, to take very seriously this issue of how the Rohingya are treated.
We must all work together to address the conditions in Rakhine State.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.